It's also true that this government claims to put a lot of emphasis on a growth agenda, and that the best way of accelerating that growth agenda in the relatively short term would be to attempt to rejoin the European Union, because that once again would be a real prospect of economic advance, 4 or 5% or whatever it is over a period of time, which the Labour Party could point to.
Hello, I'm John Stevens. I'm the chair of the Federal Trust, and I'm talking once again to Brendan Donnelly about developments in Europe and in the UK, particularly relating to Brexit. Brendan, we've had a number of developments about the UK's relationships to Europe recently, tied to the two main party conferences, that of the Labour Party and that of the Conservatives. Should we start with Labour? And this was dominated from a European point of view, I suppose, by Andy Burnham's interventions, which seemed to recommend a much more pro-European course by the Labour Party. How do you see what he was up to? And has his somewhat failed, it would seem, a leadership challenge to the Prime Minister affected that.
I think it's very interesting from the point of view of the internal politics of the Labour Party that in his, as you say, botched initiative, Europe played so large a role. I think he's come up with a calculation that many people in the Labour Party will be sharing, that there are political and economic advantages to being much more pro-European than Keir Starmer has wanted to be. And that it may well be that even if Burnham falls by the wayside as a potential successor to Starmer, we can look back and see that this was the beginning of the way in which the unconscious pro-Europeanism of the Labour Party forced its way into consciousness. I think it's an important development, even if in the short term Burnham's retreat to Manchester will take some of the heat off Starmer on the European issue.
So you don't think his retreat marks a defeat for a pro-European initiative in the Labour Party?
No, not necessarily, because I think that the arguments that he's been pointing to, political and economic, are so objectively powerful, and they're arguments which are well shared by many within the Labour Party, among the membership and among the MPs. I can't believe that that will disappear without trace. As I say, there won't be a linear progress towards a more pro-EU point of view within the Labour Party or public. Pro-EU point of view within the Labour Party, but it will go, it seems to me, in leaps and bounds. And the next time there is a major challenge to Starmer, which may well be after the May elections, I'm quite sure that Europe will then form a major plank of the programme being offered by the potential successors.
But why is it that the Prime Minister and this government has been so cautious on the EU issue, given the fact that all the polling shows a dramatic shift of opinion in favour of the proposition that Brexit was, at the very least, a very serious error and should be mitigated, if not wholly reversed?
You've made the point that one of the reasons is the need to stay relatively on side, as Starmer sees it, with Donald Trump. I don't think that can be the whole story, because even before Trump, Starmer, in the lead up to the last general election, was very cautious indeed. And clearly, there he was afraid of reform. He's still afraid of reform. There was a lot of attack on reform, and they understandably regard it, we'll talk about that later, as being the major reform part, major opposition party. But I personally think that the worry that Starmer has is that the Labour Party's coalition is fragmenting. And a traditional part of the Labour Party's coalition was northern, if you like, traditional manufacturing working class seats. And I think that he doesn't want to go down in history as the person who, by his over-enthusiasm for Europe, lost that essential component of the traditional Labour Party voting coalition.
But the core of that industrial northern vote The economic core of it is one of the principal victims of Brexit. I mean, if one looks at the problems of the British steel industry, if one looks at the problems of British motor cars, the break with the EU market has been catastrophic for that and is likely to become more so. And why the Labour Party seems incapable of making this argument is, to me, somewhat mysterious.
Well, I think that Keir Starmer, in his political analysis, is a profoundly conservative person. Having once got hold of an idea, he beats it into the ground for all that it's worth. After all, some of the issues that you're pointing to were well known in 2016. It's just a question of continuing self-deceit, desperate self-deceit, by Keir Starmer. I think there are people around him who are advising him that going too far in what might be regarded as a left-wing or progressive way is going to alienate traditional Labour voters. And there are occasions in which that's true. But I don't think Europe is any more one of them. And I think that Keir Starmer is stuck in some kind of time warp from which probably he can't personally emerge. It's only his successor that will be able to emerge.
Can we turn now to the Conservative Party
Can I just
conference?
make one or two more points about the economic and political benefits, not just for the country, but for the Labour Party? For the Labour Party, it would provide them with a narrative. People would have an answer to the question, what is it that the Labour Party stands for, which is distinctive, which is a conception of the future of the United Kingdom? And I think that that's lacking very much at the moment. It's also true that this government claims to put a lot of emphasis on a growth agenda, and that the best way of accelerating that growth agenda in the relatively short term would be to attempt to rejoin the European Union. Because that once again would be a real prospect of economic advance, 4 or 5% or whatever it is over a period of time, which the Labour Party could point to. That Rachel Reeves, when talking about a youth mobility scheme, put it in the context of it enhancing growth. Well, that's not really going to happen in the short term, and it seemed to me a pretty desperate attempt to find a new motor of growth in the long term. Of course, being more integrated in Europe will be a motor of growth, but something as peripheral as the youth mobility scheme isn't going to cut it in the way that attempting to rejoin the single market or the customs union would.
That's certainly true. And I think the principal economic challenge facing the government is the very high level of interest rates. And the one thing that would move markets, I think, in favour of allowing the UK government to borrow at more advantageous terms, terms closer to those paid by our major competitors, would be a signal that they wish to get closer to the EU and reverse the damage done by Brexit. Could we turn now to the Conservative Party and its conference? There again, Europe has loomed quite large in the form of the European Court of Human Rights, and it now seems that the Conservative Party has decided to chase reform down this particular rabbit warren and say that they would pull out of the ECHR. What are the consequences of that decision, do you think, for the Conservatives, indeed for the country and the government?
Well, I think for the Conservative Party, it's a perfectly predictable end course of a road they've been travelling for quite a long time. You remember that in Brexit, apart from the economic arguments, one of the major arguments was about foreign courts, the ECJ in the case of the European Union, holding dominion in this country. And the ECHR, in a more attenuated form, also holds some dominion in this country. And that's something that the Brexit supporting Conservative Party has always chafed at. But you're right. I think it's a desire to imitate reform which is driving this. And it's a very, very bad precedent, not even a precedent. It's part of a whole raft of policy changes, putting an end to net zero, a much more aggressive tone on race relations, on integration. What Jenrick had to say about not seeing any white faces when he was in Birmingham, it's not even a dog whistle, it's a ship's klaxon calling out to people who don't approve of the way our country's gone, and they say they want it back. Well, this is, I'm afraid, the Conservative Act, as some people say, to reform. And reform can always outreform them. And there's an insoluble conundrum for the Conservative Party, how it wins back the people it's losing to reform, because, as we all know, most of the potential voters for reform come from the Conservative ranks, so they don't come from Labour. To some extent they do, but much more from the Conservative ranks. And the conference this week in I can't really even remember where it was. The pictures told a story of empty rows, of a lack of enthusiasm, and a party which has got terminal problems.
Danny Kruger's defection could be seen by some as really underlying what you've said, which is that there is now no path for the Conservatives to capture the ground of reform. That can only now be done by reform. And his conclusion, obviously, is that the Conservative Party should essentially fold into reform. It's surprising that, in some respects, that has not yet percolated through fully, that it seems that the Conservative Party or its leadership still believe that there is this space between reform and itself that justifies its continued existence. But I mean, that doesn't seem to be very credible to me. I mean, how do you see that calculation?
Well, there was a mantra in British politics for as long as I can remember, certainly, and probably before then, about the Conservative Party having an endless capacity to reinvent itself. It was the most successful political party in the Western world. It had been in power so many years out of the past 200, and that shared myth making is something which it's very difficult for people to shake off who've grown up within the Conservative tradition. Also, it's in British politics, from one party to another. It may work, but it might be catastrophic. And there's always the argument that people have: let's wait for a few more brave or foolhardy souls to go ahead, and we may or may not follow them. So I don't think that reform at the moment are sitting round entirely waiting for conservatives to defect. I think they're not sorry to say we are different from the Conservative Party. Having the same old failed faces from the previous Conservative government wouldn't be an unmitigated blessing for reform. But I think that there will be over the next few months an increasing number of sitting MPs who go to reform, and there's safety in numbers. Once half a dozen have gone, then the next dozen or two dozen can step with greater safety.
The Conservative Party was full of references to reform and attacks on reform, as indeed was the Labour conference. But one great omission, particularly from the Conservatives, given what happened at the last general election and their losses to the Liberal Democrats, but even surprising that there was no real reference in the Labour conference either to the Liberal option, the need to create a some form of coalition, perhaps with the Liberal Democrats, in order to head off reform from the point of view of the Labour Party, and indeed from the point of view of the Conservatives, to recognise that the major losses that they suffered last time and the seats that used to be their heartland have been enormously invaded by Liberal Democrats now, and is what the most of the seats that the Liberal Democrats actually won were from the Conservatives. So, where are the Liberal Democrats in this story?
I think that there is a a general view between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party that the Liberal Democrats have reached something like their limit, that they won't be able to go much further than they can at the moment. When you talk about them as a coalition partner, of course you know as well as I do that traditionally the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, particularly their activists, reserved a special loathing for the Liberal Democrats, which they didn't demonstrate towards the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, their main rivals. That's because they're thought of as sitting ambiguously in the middle and taking votes, which patronisingly the Labour Party and the Conservative Party think they should be entitled to. I don't think, unless things change quite a lot, that the question of a coalition with the Liberal Democrats will figure on the radar of the Labour or Conservative Party until after the next general election, when if the parliamentary arithmetic dictates the possibility of a coalition, then it will come back into focus. But before that, the tribal nature of our politics makes it very difficult to talk about coalitions, even coalitions against reform.
Well, the issue for the Liberal Democrats vis-à-vis the Labour Party is, of course, whether there could be the development of an anti-reform front and an anti-reform tactical vote at the next general election. On the Conservative side, it's the question of whether they would, in fact, in their current form, under any circumstances, after the next general election, whatever is said before the general election, go into a coalition with reform. And those two facts seem to be what set the tone for the ongoing political debate. This question of whether there is a stop reform bloc or a super reform bloc assisted by what's left of the Conservative Party. But on the Liberal Democrats, I mean, they have the position of being supposedly the most pro-European party in the UK. Why is it that they have not been able to run with this more aggressively?
Well, it's an Augustinian pro-Europeanism. Oh, God make me pro-European, but not yet. They are afraid, in the same way as the Labour Party are, that they will be seen as being too pro-European. And that's exacerbated in the case of the Liberal Democrats by the fear of being seen as a single-issue party. So they are, in theory, and in the very long term, in favour of rejoining the European Union, which is not the position of Keir Starmer or obviously of Reform and the Conservatives. But it's not an issue that they regard as being a pressing one or one where they are agents and actors rather than just waiting for things to change. I think it's also true that Davy himself was always at the less pro-European, less enthusiastically pro-EU end of the Liberal Democrat spectrum. So I don't think that we can expect in the short term any major change in the rhetoric and approach of the Liberal Democrats to the European issue.
So there's no prospect, you think, of any party, any of those three parties, promising a referendum on the EU or revisiting the EU issue, perhaps after the next general election.
I don't rule that out. I think that if, which I think it's by no means impossible, the successor of Starmer weans the Labour Party or the Labour establishment away from its caution on European issues, we might well find that that in the second half of this Parliament, the Labour Party came to find that there were economic and political advantages for itself in a much more pro-European stance. And who knows what's going to happen in Europe? At the moment, that there are very acute difficulties. But in 2 or 3 years' time, particularly when this new expenditure from Germany comes through on the defence sphere, Europe may look to be a much more enticing and interesting prospect. And I can imagine, I wouldn't put it at higher than 50-50, but I think there is a real chance that the Labour Party may go into the next election promising a referendum on the European Union if it is re-elected. And then it might be that a coalition between the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party would emerge as a mathematical possible outcome after the next general election.
So the Liberal Democrats will be dragged by the Labour Party rather than the other way around, you
I
feel.
think so, yes. I think so, yes.
Well, Brendan, many thanks for that analysis, which was, as usual, most stimulating. We will continue these discussions in due course.
Thanks very much.